Hoi hoi, and welcome to the Rolling Ball Leicester Tigers fans podcast. I'm Mike, over there in the resplendent home jersey is Elliot. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I've got the merch on. I hadn't worn this one. Weirdly, this one hadn't been worn for a little while, so I thought I'd get it out into the mix.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I've seen you in that one.
It is such a good jersey. I mean, it's a shame we're going to come to the end of this. It's a topic for another podcast, actually. What do they do next season? Do they go back to the dark green, or do they keep it with the light green? I mean, they've clearly signed off on it because we're almost in May time. So it's already been signed off. It's already been made. It's probably already at the club. But it'd be really interesting to see what they're, what it's going to look like next season. But yeah, I've got the cotton one. I never bought the replica.
No, I didn't. I've come to the point that I like the tiger design by itself, but I think it's a bit too heavy on the shirt, if that makes sense.
Well, I decided that I do like a cotton version. I hadn't had a cotton home shirt for a very long time. Mm. And if I ever was the one to get, have the light green one would be the one to get back myself into for a cotton one. So yeah, The range, a whole range this year is actually pretty good. And the only one of the upsides about the Saints game is a pink kit. Can you look at that and you go, oh, that is quite nice.
Yeah, I think it's quite tasty as well. I know Charlie Clare, who we had on here, wasn't that keen about it, but I think it's mint. The dark green, I suppose the only thing that I think is pushing me towards going back to that is that because it's a light green, we end up wearing it pretty much for all our away games, and we don't get the most out of the black kit. So whether or not we're going to go back to sort of a dark green, but with then a lighter away strip, that is absolutely fine by me. But yeah, it has to be like a snazzy one. I quite like a white shirt. I think that's always quite a good one. The other thing I used to like that they used to do was when they used to play like the last home game of the season in next year's shirt. So I always thought it was quite a... They did it when we had Canterbury, didn't we? And I used to quite like that because it meant that you got to see it in action at the end of the season, a bit of a taster, and then you could kind of like get excited over the course of the season and start buying the merch when it got released in full sort of halfway through the summer.
Leicester City did that. And ironically, of all games to do it, so the last game of last season at home to West Ham, I mean, congratulations to Leicester City as they are now back up.
Oh, yeah, but, exactly. Rescued the sporting weekend again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank God for Leicester. But the irony was, of the last game of last season, they needed to win to stay up and they needed results to go the other way. But in the context of such a big game, they put out this season shirt. They did exactly the same thing. They put a new shirt on for the last game of the season. Now, normally that's a bit weird because it's in such an important game. They normally do it when they've got nothing to play for. But I quite like it when that does happen because it does make you go, it sort of builds up, like you say, the excitement.
City did that when they won the league as well. Remember the last game of the season against Everton? They wore the shirt for the next season as well. No, big fan of that. Bring it back. Although I don't know how practical it is. I suppose it depends how fussy they've been on the sign-off.
There's got to be a clause in the contract that says they've got to have X amount of... There's got to be a clause in there that sort of stops it from happening where it's got to play a certain amount of games and it's four for season, which means it's four for season rather than the crossover. I don't know. Someone cleverer for me probably knows the answer, but I'm just intrigued to know what they do next season.
No, completely agree. Well, anyway, this podcast, very, very exciting. It's going to be a bit depressing at first because we're going to get the Bristol game out of the way, which was a proper full on wallop in the bollocks. And I can only think it was similar to how Bristol felt after Bristol, or even when Guy Porter went over in our title-winning season. So it's probably about time we had the reverse done to us. So not particularly nice, but we're going to talk about it anyway. And I think we've all calmed down. We can sort of like try and dissect some of the good bits from it, as well as obviously looking at the last 10 minutes, which was monumentally frustrating. But sadly, it kind of felt, as soon as they went in for their first, I think we all went, oh no, here we go. Which is never a particularly good sign. But really excitingly, we've got Richard Cockerell. Yes, that's right. The B in the ABC club is joining us for a chat to talk about Friday's friendly fixture against Georgia Black Lion, which is the franchise from Georgia, and basically the aspirations for it. And of course, a few memories from his days at Welford Road. And most interestingly, from the training ground. He's an absolute gent, isn't he?
unbelievable. We are very lucky in what we do here, is that we get opportunities to talk to a huge amount of different people. Cocker's is up there. It's just like proper Tigers Hall of Famer, and expertly done by yourself in terms of organizing. This is where we get laughed at sometimes for our approaches for how we get guests on. No, because it works.
Yeah, exactly. Look, you bring the stats and I'll bring the sleuthing. And all I'll say is, due to some internet digging, I managed to find the media contacts. And from there, yeah, got in touch with Rich Cockrell. He's very happy to come on. I don't know if he's a listener. Probably not. But very happy to have him on. And he was a gent.
He was brilliant. Honestly, brilliant. I really enjoyed doing the interview from our perspective. I hope everyone enjoys listening to him because he was absolutely superb.
Yeah, and lots to get excited about as well for Friday night. Really sort of helps build it up. I think there's going to be really interesting Tigers team selection. It's going to be an exciting Black Lion team as well. Chance to sort of see a completely new opponent from a completely different country at Welford Road. And of course, I think it is included in your season ticket. So if you're a season ticket holder, you're not going to have to pay for a ticket. You might as well get down there and enjoy what should be a really, really good evening of rugby and the return of Richard Cockrell. Be well worth watching. And then we're going to obviously try and preview the game. We don't really know a lot about Black Lion, so I'll be relying on Richard a little bit, but we'll probably talk about the team that we'd like to see. Elliot is also going to talk in the news section about the Open Forum with Dan McKellar, which I gather from not just you, but multiple sources, was a huge success and very, very eye-opening as well. Some of the stuff I don't think we're allowed to talk about because Richard Wilkes basically started running his mouth and got told by Bondi to shut up. So just to play it safe, we're not going to talk about that. I'm sure somebody's probably nattering about it online anyway. But the stuff we think is kind of effectively out in the open anyway. We'll have a chat and we'll update you on that. As always, if you want to get in touch, please do so. Our email address is therollingmall@outlook.com and our Twitter handle is @rollingmallpod. We've got a Facebook group of the same name. Do please leave a rating and a review if you can. Be very much appreciated. And by the way, sorry, I haven't talked about Fantasy League, not just because I had a crap week, but all hit the wrong week to take Ollie Hassel-Collins out, didn't I? That was stupid. And but also the leaderboard is currently updating, so I can't give you an update on it. Before we crack on, a quick thank you to our sponsors, St. Martin's Coffee Roasters, who are helping us put this all together. St. Martin's Coffee Roasters are a small team of coffee professionals, proudly born and bred in Leicester. Family owned and operated, they've been dedicated to perfecting the art of coffee roasting for the past 10 years, solely focused on sourcing, roasting and supplying some of the world's best specialty coffee to their customers across Leicestershire and the UK. They're passionate Tigers fans and St. Martin's have long-standing connections with the club and are proud to help caffeinate the players and staff in their efforts on and off the pitch. In an effort to help the fans wake up on match days, St. Martin's Coffee Roasters are offering 20% off all coffee when listeners use the code ROLLINGMALL, that's all one word, on their website. So visit stmartinscoffee.co.uk to stock up on locally roasted specialty coffee and use the code ROLLINGMALL, all one word, to save 20% off your next purchase. The news section is brought to you by Parish Brewery, who are offering you and your pub free beer. Now that I've got your attention, Parish Brewery award-winning ales are brewed in a 400-year-old converted stable block in Borough-on-the-Hill in rural East Leicestershire. It's here that they follow the traditional ways of brewing, using only the finest ingredients to brew their cask-conditioned beer. In addition to the many beer festival awards, the brewery is the proud recipient of a Guinness Book of World Records award in 1994 for having brewed the world's strongest beer at that time, Baz's Superbrew, and its offspring, Baz's Bonce Blower, is still going strong. Very strong, but absolutely delicious. So back to the free beer, Parish are offering you the chance to win 4 perfect pints of their ale to enjoy at your local. All you have to do is tell them on Instagram or Facebook what your favourite Parish flavour is. If you're yet to try one, you can check out which one will tickle your taste buds by visiting parishbrewery.co.uk. Not only will you win, but so will your pub, as they'll be gifted a free pin, and that's 36 delicious pints to you and I. So get on your socials, tell Parish your favourite flavour, and get a chance for some free beer. It's that easy. Participating pubs only. All entrants must be 18 or over. Full terms and conditions apply. Oakley dokily, time for some beep, 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 beep news, and time for our favourite topic of the season, the attack coach situation, which is, of course, the saga that's been dragging on all year with Alan Dickens on leave. And there seems to be some rumours that a change is afoot, that there is going to be an incoming appointment. Elliot, can you tell us a little bit more?
Peter Hewitt is the name mentioned in the Telegraph last week. And as we've always said, if it appears in the Telegraph, it's usually a pretty safe bet that it's not longer a rumour. It's a rumour with a bit more substance to it. So I think it's fairly... And then to be fair, McKellar then was asked about it by Adam Whitty on Friday and effectively didn't confirm it, but then didn't particularly deny it either. So I think it's a pretty safe bet that Hewitt is going to be the attack coach next year. And he has worked... This is where it gets interesting, because he has obviously he's played in England with London Irish.
Lost in the 2009 final, if I believe. That was a pig of a game, actually. Not Peter Hewitt's fault, but he's a point out. But I just remember that it was one try. I was in Australia when I was watching it, and I just remember I was like, oh, I stayed up for this. I think Jordan Crane, or was it Ben Woods scored?
Jordan Crane, I think it's like from 1 yard out, just reached his arm through. And put it down. So I think it's taken 15 years to get over it and forgive us. But no, I think obviously it's in Japan at the moment in a head coach role, and it will obviously come over to us if rumours are to be true and join us as an attack coach. The most important thing of all of this is that one, is an experienced coach. Secondly, is a head coach somewhere else. But thirdly, he's worked with McKellar before. And I think that is the aspect of which I think I'm most happy by or satisfied by, because it's McKellar's man. And that's a good thing for me for multiple reasons. One, you've got someone that is, you know, there's knowledge there. So they instantly rate each other and they're happy to work with each other. And that's a massive thing. So from a relationship perspective. Secondly, if he's worked with McKellar before, he knows McKellar's methods. He knows the game plan that McKellar wants to implement, which means he's fully on board with that thinking, that philosophy, and he's more than happy to coach it. So you've got an alignment from a coaching perspective. And I think it's important for McKellar to have his own people around him, because ultimately, he didn't want to say it like this, but ultimately, if it does go wrong, there is no excuses then. You know, there is
He doesn't want a fallback excuse, does he? He doesn't want to kind of like be able to say, well, you know, actually my philosophy doesn't really line up with the person who I was given. And actually, it's great because it gives him the best chance of implementing his vision on the club, if it is someone, like you say, he trusts and works with. I think there's a little bit of concern that is it Black Rams, I think Peter Hewitt looks after in Japan. I don't think they're doing particularly well, and the rumour was he's going to get the chop anyway. But I do know that from talking to a couple of people in the game, he's really highly rated as an attack coach. And we all know there are lots of reasons why a team might not be performing so well. It may be that he's not quite ready for their head coach step up yet. But effectively, certainly when it comes to running the attack, he's got a really, really good reputation. He's really progressive. He's can align well with a pragmatic game plan as well. So I think that, you say, ticks all the boxes for me. But then again, after having a season of no attack coach, I'd be pretty happy with most options at the moment. But this genuinely seems exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the fact that he can hit the ground running on July the 1st is important, because it's a big pre-season. And having an attack coach who is fully aligned with McKellar, and that every coach is fully on board from day one of pre-season is massive, because we've got to hit the ground running in pre-season. So yeah, I think it's an exciting transfer rumour in terms of coach. And I think Saturday showed that the attack is where the game, as weirdly as it sounds, was the issue, because conceding 21 points to Bristol isn't really an issue. That's actually an achievement, considering how many points they scored on a pretty regular basis. Our issue is he would only scored 19, which, considering all the, and we'll get into the game, so I don't want to tell you too much, but given all the dominance and all the territory and all the pressure that we'd had, to only scored 19 points is the problem. And when we did the statistics last week, it wasn't the points conceded that was the issue, it's the points scored. We're only scoring 22 points on average per game. You know, you look at the year we won the title, I think it was 28, 29 on average. So, you know, this Saturday was a perfect encapsulation of what the issue is, that we're not scoring enough points, and that because we're not scoring enough points, we're getting caught in these bun fights, and we're at the moment on the wrong side of them. Whereas if we scored more points, you're outside, you get over 30 points in the game, you should be winning most games, especially with our defence. So an attack coach is desperately, desperately needed. And I'm excited that, especially after listening to Mikel, we have one that he's, in theory, he's happy with and is excited to have on board.
Yeah, breaking news. Scoring points helps you win games. very, very exciting. Slightly less exciting, slightly sadder, is the list of development players who are being released. I think there are some who, I think because they're in competitive positions or perhaps they haven't had as many opportunities or not kicked on like we hope, weren't particularly surprising. There are a few who did raise an eyebrow. But Elliot, why don't you go and reel off the list?
So we've got Jacob Cusick, Oliver Crane, Sam Edwards, Morgan Meredith, and Simon Coriardi, who will all be departing at the end of the season.
Yeah, it's sad, obviously, to see young talent go, particularly as we've seen it before, where it can come back and bite us when they develop somewhere else. But I think we've seen it before where we keep a close eye on players and obviously bring them back when we think actually they've developed really well, getting regular rugby in the championship or whatever it may be. So hopefully we do keep the connection strong and obviously best of luck to all of them. Simon Coriardi was the one that I was quite surprised at. I haven't seen a lot of him this season though, and maybe that sort of speaks volumes. We obviously don't see how they're performing in training, but I always thought he looked like he could be quite a handful when I've been watching sort of like him playing in the youth teams and things like that, and his various forays in the Premiership Cup last season.
Yeah, it's also, you also don't know if there have been, you know, other clubs are going to be out there and they're just putting offers on the table down, which ultimately are better for the player than what, you know, it might not just be that they're being released. It might be that they've got other offers on the table, you know, that tickles, that takes their fancy and it's better for them, whether it's in terms of career development or just in money or in terms of playing opportunities or whatever it is, yeah, or just lifestyle. You know, these are young guys that want to do different things. And if you've got an opportunity to do something that's more in line with what you want to do, and you can get your rugby alongside that, then that's obviously important as well. So I think it's very easy in these situations to sort of hammer the club and just go, oh, why is such and such leaving? When there's a million different reasons why a player can leave the club and we don't see what goes on day to day. And there's usually a good reason why a young player leaves. It's sad, but we can't take everyone through. And you've got to make sure that you get more right than you do get wrong. And I think judging by Tigers over the last few years, I think they get more right than they do wrong. So that's a nice ratio to be having, I guess.
Absolutely. I think that, to be honest, our record has been pretty good over recent years of bringing young players in. I know there's been a bit of frustration this season, but I think for various reasons, I think next season we'll see a lot more of these younger players sort of step up. I think that Sam Edwards was the one that sort of seemed to get the most sort of public trash and surprise that he was being let go. But I wonder if this is a situation because he's been signed by Bristol where he's been signed as a third choice there on more money when he might be staying at on less money as a fourth choice at Tigers. And yeah, it's a difficult one because, you know, if you can't guarantee him effectively more regular rugby, like you say, maybe that, you know, going to Bristol and obviously they've got a really exciting game plan. I can see why it would appeal to him. And also, I've got to be honest, like, we don't know what the clubs see in terms of like actually the next wave of players coming through. Could be that there's someone in under 17s or even under 18s who is really sort of catching the eye. And we think, well, actually, we think this guy's got a higher ceiling. But in order to facilitate him coming through and being able to make a breakthrough when he's in his late teens, early 20s, we need to remove some of the traffic ahead of him.
It's always tough to back which horse to get on board with. You've got to back the right horse. And sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. But like you said, they see a lot more than what we do.
I think there was a choice between Cam Jordan and George Martin. I think.
Yes.
I think Cam Jordan may have been the year above George Martin, but I just wonder if that was one of those choices because we see Cam Jordan playing for Gloucester. Look, he's a really good player, but he's not at George Martin's level. So that's perhaps a good example of backing the right horse.
Yeah, agreed.
Let's also talk about the forum yesterday, which, as I say, I've heard from lots of people, was a really, really good success. Very upfront, very honest, sometimes too honest from Richard Wilkes, but a really good chat. And obviously, as I said before, we can't talk about all of it, but I think there's some really interesting snippets. Why don't you just give us a quick overview, Elliot?
Yeah, so effectively, it was supposed to be Dan Palmer, Dan Mikel, and Richard Wilkes. unfortunately, Dan Palmer was ill, so it was just Dan McKellar and Richard Wilkes. And actually, it was actually very interesting. So you had head coach and general manager and Bondi up on stage. And as you said, there's a lot of stuff which we can't talk about, and there's some that we can. So apologies if we don't, if you feel like we're holding back, that the club very specifically asked everyone in the room to keep a lot of stuff quiet. I thought it was a really good opportunity. And sometimes in these things, you just go, oh, it's a bit soft soap, and you just get a couple. It was just all easy questions and it was all heavily managed. It actually wasn't, in terms of Bondi was on stage with them, opened up with a couple of half follies to get them going, but then it was thrown up to the floor and it was a genuine open forum. So Dan and Bondi were picking up people to ask their questions. I think there's probably about 25, 30 questions asked, maybe even more, which is good. There's some really good questions. A couple of questions which were genuinely good questions, but probably better for Andrea, who was also there, rather than the two guys on stage. But it was a very, very good evening. If you do, and the important thing is that the club are going to do more of these next season. So this is just the first start of many different open access events, not just to players, but to coaches and different members of staff. So when they're advertised, I do recommend getting on board if you can. They are good fun. In terms of the evening, I thought McKellar, I'd be really interested to hear from anyone who walked into the room cynical about McKellar. And that's perfectly understandable if you did walk in going, huh, not sure about you. It'd be really interesting to see what, if you were in that situation, how you feel about McKellar as you walked out the room. Because that's ultimately more interesting, possibly from my opinion, because actually it depends whether we convinced you or not. I personally was really impressed with Dan McKellar. I'm really impressed listening to him in this sort of setting. You know, he's done a couple of podcasts and a couple of interviews over the years before he joined Tigers. And these types of settings, I think he comes across as a really good speaker. And he's someone that can talk about rugby in a really engaging way. And you feel really comfortable listening to him. He talks really well and he's got some really interesting ideas. And I enjoy listening, genuinely enjoy listening to him. And last night was actually a really good setting for him. He was very honest in terms of the performances and results haven't been good enough. He was very upfront and honest about that. But he was also stands behind, he's very confident about the belief of how he sees this squad going and the vision he's got. And I came away with it from the evening very, I still have belief in him and that he can and actually will deliver success for us. And I think his vision is the central part of all of that, this. And there's clearly some frustrations this year about certain things that have gone on. And, you know, we talk about the attack coach situation. And it's clearly something that I think that has annoyed him, is obviously the way it's played out as it is. Because ultimately, there's some coaches that, some head coaches value different specialisms more than others. So for example, Steve, he would value a defence coach more than anything else. As you saw when he left the Tigers, he took Kev, the defence coach, with him, and then he took Alan. So defence and then fitness are the big things, the key pillars to Steve's game. For Dan, the attack coach is almost central to his philosophy. Because he, as a forwards coach, can drill the set piece and the line out. And we've seen that this year, both of those things. And the general forward play has been pretty good. But the attack coach has been, the attack situation has been where we've fallen down. And it's clear to me that he has, the attack coach is the central piece of how he coaches the team. And to have not had access to one is clearly something that has frustrated him. So it would be really interesting. He did say that, look, we've got a full preseason coming up. It's another preseason. It's a year into of learning about his own players, their strengths and weaknesses, and how they operate as people. He's learned a lot about the league. He's learned about the opposition. He's learned about opposition teams, opposition coaches, opposition grounds. You know, he's not been to some of these grounds before. You know, he didn't. It sounds really stupid, but just whole things about the league, how the league officiates. He said there's a big difference in refereeing up here compared to Super Rugby. Down under in Super Rugby, the touch judges are very, very active in terms of getting involved in helping out the man in the middle. As your old man can attest to up here, they do not do that at all. And they are literally...
Well, it seems to be really touching. It's never consistent, is it? It never, ever consistent. Sometimes they'll flag a knock-on when the ref's out of sight. Other times, they'll just ignore it. And we saw that at the weekend. I remember one touch judge on the far side, to where the cameras are on the far side to the Crumbly, called a knock-on. And then there was another one that led to effectively Bristol's non-try, Mike Brown's yellow, where they where there was a knock on and the touch judge was just silent about it. Absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as it's now appeared on different forms, I think we're safe to say this, that Dan Kelly isn't going anywhere. And they were quite adamant about that. There is a centre coming in. A couple more signings were sort of hinted at, but it wasn't sort of expanded upon. It was confirmed that we're signing up to the Cat, which is, again, what has been confirmed, but it was, again, nice to have that confirmed in the evening. Parisi is actually a really interesting signing, Izzy Parisi. Michele announced that he'd been wanting to sign him since he was 17, which is, I think, is a great bit of chasing. Mm. I should point out when Parisi was 17, not when Michele was 17, just to make sure we got the numbers right on that one.
So, yeah, he was waiting in the birthing suite with a contract ready to sign.
Yes.
I'll tell you who I would have done that for, Logo Mulipola's children, because didn't he marry Castro's sister?
There's some front row genes.
Yeah, and I think they had twin boys as well. I mean, those are your two props set up there. And I think Cockers was the head coach at the time. I should have asked him that. I should have asked him, were you in the birthing suite waiting with a couple of contracts?
I mean, that is fantastic, just to get them on the, at least get them a membership at least.
Get them on the books. Get them on the books early.
Yeah, off cap. I think that's a real big thing that we've got with Parisi, because we don't watch Super Rugby. So the fact that Michele is a big fan of Izzy Parisi and is effectively been chasing him for such a long time, I think is a real good indication of his quality and of how much Michele values him. Some really interesting stuff about just in terms of the challenges that we have, just in terms of being victims of our own success, really. Obviously, for the title winning year, we had a host of young players effectively playing at top level premiership quality, if not international, if not world-class quality. We had them available for all year, and actually they were on contracts.
Well, they were all on development contracts, weren't they?
Absolutely. So effectively, you could put seven or eight players together that cost somewhere between £300,000 to £400,000 a year. Now, I don't know the specific numbers, and again, it wasn't spoken about, but the cost of those same seven or eight players to contract them is probably a lot more. You know, it's probably at least £1 million more to keep those same players on the books. And obviously, yeah, we want to keep those players because they're the future. And that, in turn, it tells you the sort of challenges that the club faces in terms of, if you want to, you know, in the terms of the depth and how to contract players and how to get players in and new signings, because you're constantly up against it where you've got a moving thing, where you've got these players that you want to keep, but they are dramatically going through the gears in terms of their value. And we are having to keep up with that. And that provides a challenge across the salary cap. Some really good stuff from in terms of our development and our pathways. I think this one, again, is pretty fair to be said in terms of we've been awarded best in class for player development from an external audit. So that's across all the teams.
In the Premiership.
Yeah, and it's the ability to get a player from the academy up into the first team and beyond. And we are considered the best in class for that. And they did mention that for us, obviously, without an A-League, the A-League was and is a valuable tool for us, but obviously that no longer exists. And that is a challenge, because going from 18 into the first team is a massive gulf. So a lot of the challenge is to try and get them, it's to try and bring these young players through. And they did mention, obviously, we've got the different relationships in terms of Nottingham, Leicester Lions and Loughborough as our key development points that they've. So it's good to see that whilst in an ideal world we'd have an A-League, we don't. But it's nice to see that the club have been rewarded for their ability to bring players through. So that is really, really good. I think the last point, which I think I can mention, is just about next year. I think you'll see young players filling the gaps in the squad. I know Andrea sort of hinted at it in our interview with us. It was referenced last night. And I think when you start looking at the senior players that have left and you start looking at the sort of development guys who haven't been released, you can start seeing where the gaps are going to be filled. And you can always see which decisions have been made and which young players are going to be stepping up and filling in. So I think that to me is a really exciting sign for next season, in terms of you're going to see young players. It might just be that Michele just looked at him and said, look, you're all good players, but you're just a year off in your development. So I want you around, but you're just not quite, you just need another year, another 12 months. And I think that's exciting for us that they've had that 12 months of physical development. You know, likes of Finn Kahn, Durf, Archie Vaines, Finn, Theobald Thomas were all referenced last night, as was Joe Woodward, as players are all excited by. So I think that tells a story of, you know, who's going to be sort of featuring next season and who's done really well for the club. The I would say the last, and this is a summing up thing, I really did enjoy listening to Mikel. And I know this season has been tough. And the best thing about last night was that no one in the room shied away from that, from the club. So in terms of Wilksie or down on stage, they didn't sit there and try and pull the wool over eyes or try and claim that everything's rosy. They're honest to admit that results and performances haven't quite been where they want it to be. But they are big believers in terms of what they want to do and where they want to take the team and the central belief that runs through it. And they did say that, look, they do believe that, as we sort of echoed last week, that there is a, it just comes down to fine margins between success and failure. And ultimately, there isn't a lot of difference between being eighth like we are and being in the top four and potentially with a trophy on our hands. So this is, it's, I would just urge everyone just to be calm and patient, because I understand everyone gets frustrated. And we'll talk about the Bristol game. No one looked more disappointed and was more hurt by it than Dan. I think, you know, he said it himself that Sunday was a tough day in terms of he found it tough. It was incredibly disappointing. And there was other members of the coaching group who were equally inconsolable when he was having discussions with them on Sunday. So look, I think there is an acknowledgement on stage that it is tough. After listening to him, it's quite clear, and listening to the club actually, it's quite clear that they know a lot more than what we as fans do, because they see a lot more than we do. Mm-hmm. And they have conversations and they have discussions with the higher up authorities. And I think the club are ultimately frustrated that they can't communicate some of this stuff to us as fans, and they would like to, but they're obviously being told by the RFU or other bodies what they can and can't say. And they're frustrated because they want to tell us stuff and they can't. And that's frustrating. But it was a really good evening. I enjoyed listening to Dan, and credit to the club for putting it on. And yeah, really good evening.
Yeah, thank you, mate. That was a very interesting monologue, and I don't mean that sarcastically, but because that was...
I put everyone to sleep, mate.
That generally, as I said, you know, obviously I live very, very far away, and I'm just a mere super member, not a season ticket holder like yourself. So it was good to get an insight. And yeah, kudos to the club for putting it together, because it sounds like it was a really good evening that was enjoyed by all, you know, for what it's worth. I think I very much sit in the setting that I think that he has a plan. I think there's been sufficient mitigation this season. I'm not saying, you know, kind of Dan's done everything right, but I think there's been sufficient mitigation to say that, look, needs a second season with effectively everything, you know, that he wants in place. That is a good full preseason with most of the squad. That is having them available, you know, for the start of the season. Obviously, we'll have to take into account rest periods and stuff. But also having an attack coach and having had a season to bed in as well. And I'll point to Van Graan again. I don't think that you get a huge amount by chopping and changing. And, you know, look, he's thrown everything into this. He can reevaluate this season, see what's worked, what hasn't worked. And yeah, I'm happy to see him get another crack of it next season. All right, should we get it out of the way?
Should we rip the Band-Aid off?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, it's a good job that the guys that do the Bears Beyond the Gate podcast are very nice.
They are good lads.
They are good lads, so I'm very happy for them. And like I said, I think it's about time they gave us a return sucker punch, given what's happened in a few fixtures recently. So, yeah, look, that was one of the hardest defeats I've had the misfortune of watching. And I know at the time, a lot of people were very, very upset. I think because I had sort of the kids at the time and I was sort of like trying to juggle watching the match and playing with them and stuff, I didn't quite get as angry as I usually do or as frustrated. Instead, I sort of, I suppose, took a more holistic approach and sort of, I've definitely sort of calmed down in the days afterwards. And I think there's stuff you can take from that performance. But I think it is our season in a nutshell. really. And there is stuff that is really frustrating from the players, and there is some stuff that falls on the shoulders of the coaches. But I think they all know that. I don't think that's saying anything new.
Saturday hurt a lot, and defeats like Saturday hurt a lot, because if you get hosed 40 points to 10 or whatever, you can deal with that because you're not good enough and you're well off on the day, and you can walk away just going, they were the better side, clearly the better side, we weren't, and you go away and you can deal. I find that personally easier to deal with. Saturday was hard, and days like Saturday are hard to deal with because you are so close to winning, painfully close to winning. And for 70 minutes, I know McKellar got a bit of heat for it, but his comments after the game, but for 70 minutes, there was a lot of good stuff out there. Tigers played very, very well for 70 minutes. And there's stuff, it wasn't perfect, and there's a few things to work on. But for 70 minutes, they did a pretty good job overall of playing. The unfortunate reality is the game plays for 80 minutes, not 70. And that is the fundamental issue, is that for whilst we were very, very good for 70, for the last 10 minutes, we were the complete opposite. And that's the issue, is that for that final 10 minutes, we've made several mistakes and compounded them, and then they sort of added up and it became an issue, and it cost us the game. And like you said, that it was the season in a nutshell Saturday, because, and I spoke about it earlier, we had so much territory, we had so much red zone pressure, we had so much control of the game. Our defence was pretty good across the board for 70 minutes and stopping them and forcing them back. But we just didn't have enough points on the board. And all it took was maybe one more try, and you're on 27 or 26 or 28 points on the conversion. You're done. At that point, you are done. You've got the bonus point, and it's just a case of, even if you can see a couple of tries, it doesn't matter. You've got 28 points. You've got the buffer. And it's that fundamental point. If we just don't have enough buffer for when something bad happens, whether it's in our control or out of our control, whether it's a mistake that we make or good play by the opposition, we just do not have the buffer there to be able to cope with that. And that was basically what happened Saturday. And I felt sorry for the players because they'd worked so hard. And this is where you've just got to play for 80 minutes, because every team in the division can hurt you. And a team like Bristol, they don't need much of a sniff. And they got a sniff. And boy, did they take it. And it hurts.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And like you say, fair play to Bristol for staying in the game. But I think I'll start with one negative, which is, I think we've talked about it a bit this season, our sort of mentality to compound errors and to kind of fall off things a little bit as well. And I think when that first try went over, I was a little bit worried. I got the sense the crowd was as well. When Brownie went off, got his second yellow, which I would have had sympathy for had it not been for his monumentally stupid. I love Brownie. I love him. He's great. But this was not his best moment. The hand in the ruck, which was cynical play. So he got his first yellow. Going a man down against Bristol for the last 10 minutes, along with like Northampton, we've gone a man down, being given a red card against the two best attacking sides. And going a man down for the last 10 minutes against Bristol, particularly a back three player, given how they defend in a pendulum action, et cetera, et cetera, was an absolute killer. You've got a team that stretches you from side to side in any event, and now you're doing it with a man down, and particularly a guy on the edge. And they were able to find that edge to make these big breaks upfield. Harry Thacker, as predicted, comes back to haunt us again. And you know that. Then I thought, I think that we're in quite a bit of trouble here. And it was just kind of like they say, just little mistakes. Like I think for Lahiff's second try, Wellesley's on the guard, and he doesn't make a contact really on Lahiff. He sort of misses it. And effectively, then you've got Ollie Hassel Collins trying to tackle two tight five forwards. You know, I thought Hassel Collins had a great game. We'll come to him in a bit because I want to talk about the positives. But those are the sorts of things that they'll be picking up and saying, you know, look, any one of those things changes, then, you know, effectively the game's won. And unfortunately, it just was the case that we make too many errors at key times when the pressure comes on. And I'd just be interested to say that how the players don't seem to have the confidence to see these situations out. They can get in a good position, but often can't hold on to it. And I think we've talked a bit about conditioning as well. And again, it's hard to say because we get down to 14 men. People were saying that we were looking leggy. And I don't know if I agree that conditioning is a weakness, but I don't necessarily think it's a strength that it has been in previous seasons. I don't think we're the fittest team in the league anymore. And I think we were.
No, I think that's fair. I think that's very fair. I think there's a couple of points. You're right. Brownie going off is painful for a couple of reasons. One, because of the position he plays in. And secondly, he's the most experienced player on the pitch. So a lot of rugby IQ walked off the pitch with him. So effectively, when you're down in the trenches on the last 10 minutes and you are going to come into the pump, just having someone as experienced as Brownie on the field would have helped. Just as even if it was just a calmness of just a bit of shithousery, just to slow the clock down or just chew up 20 seconds here, 30 seconds there, and just to have got us over the line in a few bits of moments or just extra leadership. So that obviously didn't help. The fitness thing for me is, and you're right of how you phrased that. To me, we are not an unfit team. The team are fit. The issue is that, I think you're right in saying how you've worded it, is we are not the fittest team in the league. And to play the game that we are playing, which is effectively we're still a defensive squeeze team. And what I mean by that is that we're going to use our defensive efforts to squeeze the life out of the opposition. And what that effectively means is that all the teams in this league work hard and they're all fit. What we're saying is we're going to outwork you because by our act of outworking you, we will force you to make errors. And by you making errors is what we will capitalize on to score our points, to get our control of the game and to get our territory. So you have got to be the fittest team in the league because you've got to be able to outwork them and you've got to be able to outwork a team for 80 minutes to force those mistakes. And you've got to scramble and you've got to work extremely, extremely hard. And the issue is that we are not the fittest team in the league. So therefore, play the game in terms of that style, of that defensive squeeze team or that defensive pressure team and how we want to play it. It just means that, especially against a team like Bristol, where you're having to work so, so hard, and they have worked so hard. You could see them, Matt Scott going from side to side to side. I was tracking him for a couple of phases. I was just tracking him and he was just sprinting so, so far and to get into the defensive line and he was always making his tackles and we were physical and we were hitting rocks. They work so hard. But because they're not in that condition that maybe they need to be to play that game, it just catches up with you in the end. And I don't know what they do during the week. And it might not even be a fitness thing. It might just be a loading during the week thing. And it might be that they need to review what they do during the week because that might be affecting them. But it was certainly true that at the crucial moment in the game, we just did not have the legs when the pressure came on. And I think there was a few things in terms of, I think the team deep down knew they hadn't scored enough points. And I think as soon as that first try went over...
I think there is a confidence thing there saying, shit, now we've got to see this out, as opposed to being like, well, it doesn't matter, we'll just go back down and score another try.
And because they didn't quite have the fitness that they did last year, I think it's a compounding thing mentally where you just go, shit. And it's that panic, internal panic. And they're all young lads, and I think we should recognise this. For a lot of, I know they've played a lot of games, and maybe they could be a bit more experienced at this, but they're still young lads. They're only 22 to 23. You're asking them to do big boy shit, and sometimes it's hard, and it's a learning curve for a lot of them out there, and they'll probably be better for it as rugby players and as people to have to go through a bit of shit like this. It's hard, but you will learn more from it. But I think there was an internal panic because they knew they didn't have enough points on the board. There was maybe an internal worry, but they didn't have the legs to get to the last. And they knew they were under the pump. And suddenly when Brownie went off, that was almost compounded all of that even further. And all it takes is just a slip and you just go, oh, a panic, a mild panic turns into full blown, fucking hell. And it almost had that approach of where something relatively last year, for numerous different reasons, adversity happened and they could cope with it. This time round, they're just not in that same position.
I think as well, at that point, you've got Hanro, who has come off. There goes a leader. Vad Hoolihan, the Emperor, comes off. And actually, I have to say, I thought Charlie Clare was really good when he came on, had a really good game. But, you know, those are two of your big senior leaders there.
Paulie's not on the pitch. Lenny's not picked.
Yeah, exactly. And these are the things that kind of like sometimes you want to turn around and see sort of like that experienced face, someone who's been through this and kind of says, look, lads, just fucking keep it together. Next job. And I'm not saying they don't say that, but I think it inspires a bit more belief when it's coming from someone you know has been there and done it at the highest level. And it probably just isn't quite the same without those guys on the pitch. That said, like, I think there was a lot of really good stuff. And like I said, I've tried to take a more holistic approach. And I've got to say, I thought the defence was outstanding for, you know, well, we have, say 15, obviously Brownie was off for 10. But actually, our defence, by and large, was outstanding. Bristol cut teams to shreds regularly and have been doing that since, you know, the return of the Six Nations break, where they've been in incredible form. They put 50 on Northampton. They put 80 on Newcastle. And when we were 65 minutes in, they were on nil point. They hadn't looked like scoring particularly. I know they had a disallowed try, which was for a marginal forward pass, perhaps a bit of justice because there was a knock-on in the build-up to that anyway. Which obviously Brownie thought there was, but there was, you know, the defence was magnificent. Not, I thought DK and Scotty in the midfield were superb. DK at 12, I thought his best game for a long time, both in terms of with the ball, his carrying, his distribution, but also particularly without the ball, real sort of glue player in defence, and thought he had a really, really strong game. Scotty gave blood literally for the cause. He was doing everything we expect him to do, like hitting hard, just being really organised in attack, not letting anything get outside his channel. We're really clever with when we pressed and when we didn't. We would let them pass, we'd drift and then push up, and we force them into mistakes on their own line. The unfortunate thing was that we couldn't always capitalise on it. The ruck security for both sides, to be fair, but particularly for us, was not particularly good throughout the game. I'll come on to that later because I wonder if that was a sort of a key thought when we had the ball in the middle of the field with, you know, 2 minutes left and refs are really, really hot on you sealing off, whether or not that is something that goes through the thought process of the players. But on the defensive side, it wasn't just that. It was because Bristol will always make breaks. It was then the scramble was superb. And I think there was the one bit, wasn't there, where they've made a break through the middle. And I think Stewart, Trent's water, he doesn't come up to meet the player. He sort of buys time, allows JVP to hair back. Great pace by him. I think it's, is it Hewitt who he caught? Or, I'm not sure.
Rich Lane?
Rich Lane, thank you. He catches Rich Lane by complete surprise. But it's also made by DK sprinting back on our diagonal, basically to cut off the inside pass. Like, massive work rate. That was huge. We had Chez, who was monumental. He did not deserve to be on a losing side. Chasing down Vakatawa. The burst of pace he put on, a fresh Vakatawa, and he's about 60, 65 minutes into the game, and he puts on a burst of pace to haul down Vakatawa, I thought was just absolutely incredible. I mean, he had some game. His carrying is coming on leaps and bounds now as well. Really, really aggressive. And actually, I thought all of our young England contingent were outstanding. I thought Freddie Stewart was superb back in his 15 shirt. JVP at 9 was excellent. And George Martin, first game back, considering that, you know, he's not played rugby for a little while, it's just his hard carries, you know, into traffic. He is always going through a player, whether he gets clean through or whether he just knocks them backwards and takes an extra meter or so. They're such valuable yards. And I thought all four of those guys were absolutely outstanding. And I thought out of everyone in the starting lineup, I thought, you know, obviously Brownie had his sort of mishaps, but he had good moments as well. And I thought everyone in the starting lineup had a really good game. I think the issue came not because of the players who came on the bench, but because of the situation that they found themselves in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, if you're to draw up, that's what it sounds like. If you draw up like a player scorecard after 70 minutes, 7, 8, 9, you know, no one really had a bad game. I thought DK at 12 showed that he's the 12. I thought the attack looked better, you know, with him at 12, running alongside Pollard. I thought we were able to get to the ball to the width a lot better. I thought attacking shape better. In fact, I thought Ollie Hassel-Collins was brilliant. Should we go on and talk about Ollie?
Because because he's had a bit of stick and, you know, we thought it's a bit of confidence. And what I liked was that there were a couple of times there was an absolute beauty of a pill from Pollard in the first half, where he just puts out the plate. Hassel-Collins doesn't break stride, eats up 20 metres down the left wing. Kelly puts him in for a try as well with a beautiful sort of like wide pass. He held his width well. He cut inside. He created a lot of havoc. that's the Hassel Collins that we know. That's the guy that we signed. You can do that sort of damage. Of course, it was the game that I took him out of my fantasy team. So I might keep him out now just because it seems to be a good luck charm. But I thought he was excellent as well. And in phases, sometimes the attack looked a bit better, particularly when we looked to hit the width quite quickly. I thought that it looked really good. And actually, even when we run up through the middle, and as usual, when we go through the first three phases, we kind of go, oh, hello, this is looking quite handy. We vary the play quite nicely. The issue for me comes when we get beyond three phases in attack. And then I think the lack of attack coach shows, because that we don't have this system like embedded in our subconscious. So we're like, okay, brilliant. You know, we've taken a couple of phases forward. Now we go and run particular strike move, or you're effectively, you're always in the same setup, but you're going to run different, or you're in the same pattern, but effectively you're picking different options each time. There was one bit in particular, where Pollard is screaming for it on the right because Bristol are really overloaded on one side. He screams for it on the right. He senses the space is there. Ball comes to him, and I think there's only Coley there who probably hasn't moved for 10 minutes. He's probably still getting up from the last scrum. And he has to go back in and take contact. And obviously, he's sensing that's where the space is, but the attack hasn't sort of like wrapped around outside. Now, I don't know whether that's Pollard basically going rogue and going right, but there was space there. But we didn't have a reaction to him going that way. It just wasn't joined up at key times when there were opportunities to take the space. And I think I've said this before, I think Pollard is a fantastic fly half when he's operating within a system where everybody knows their role. Because I think he's a bit like Farrell, you know, he can operate and he can be a general, but I don't think he can almost do what Fordy does, which is sort of he will be screaming for everyone to be where they are at all times. Basically, he's shouting at 15 blokes to be where they need to be at any given moment in a game. It's like having an on-field coach. I don't think Pollard is that player. I think he's got lots of other strengths, but it's just, as I say, we don't have it ingrained in our DNA to react to situations at the moment.
No, I think all spot on. I completely agree. It's what Saturday showed is that when you are able to manipulate defence and get Ollie Hassel-Collins into space, he scores tries. You know, he's a pure finisher. And it was quite interesting when I looked at his stats. We did this yesterday. 9 tries this season from 20 appearances. It's almost a 1-in-2 hit rate. And that's the team that's had attack issues all year. You know, I think that shows you that for all the sort of noise that goes around Ollie Hassel-Collins, the issue is that he's a pure finisher. And one of the things he's been doing this year, actually that goes unnoticed or unappreciated, is he's adding the all-round stuff to his game. Because at this club, we ask our wingers to be all-rounders in terms of you've got to work hard, you're chasing, your defensive work, you need to bust, do your busting with your carrying. And he wasn't asked to do that. They were happy to have him as a pure finisher. So he's had to learn his all-round game, but it shows that if you look at his games across the year, I actually think he's added to his all-round game. I think he's added his kick chasing. I think his defensive work is good. He's gone busy, gone looking for work. And when he does get an opportunity, he takes it. And it doesn't need acres and acres of space. He just needs half a bit of space just to get through. And it shows. And really impressed with it. I was really pleased for him. And I think 9 tries from 20 this year in a team that struggled with an attack gives you hope and positivity for next year. Because if we can get it clicking, you've got an absolute rogue finisher. He's going to score, you know, he's a bagsman. He's going to keep scoring. And it's like a football. If you've got a striker that relies on service, you're not giving him service, well, he ain't going to score because you're not giving him chances. If you give Ollie chances, it's going to score. I was also pleased for him because I managed to create a chance for him. So,
I knew you were going to bring this up. Go on then. You got to sing it.
Oh yeah, to the tune of the Wenger bus is coming. It's the Leicester boys are scoring with Ollie Hassel-Collins. He scores them on the left wing. He scores them on the right wing. The Leicester boys are scoring with Ollie Hassel-Collins.
I need my glow sticks. It's excellent. I like it. Good luck getting the terrorists to start singing the Wenger boys though.
Mate, it's why I deliberately chose it's provocative.
Very nice. the scrum was a bit up and down. It was weird because at one point, I think the first few, I thought we've got these boys. And then we seemed to be under pressure. And I don't know the shenanigans that went in. I would say that when we were on top, we seemed to be going straight forward. When they were on top, it seemed to be coming diagonally, we'll put it that way. I think that I don't pretend to know. We need Jess here to talk about it. But it wasn't the dominant force it was. And I think, again, with all due respect to Will Hurd, I think we miss Hazy, you know, within that sort of, you know, coming off the bench and sometimes even upping what, you know, building on what Coley's done, because he's such a fantastic scrummager in his own right now.
Bristol do a very good job at stopping, historically, have always done a pretty good job of stopping our rolling maul. We don't really score, even under Steeds, when we were scoring rolling maul tries by the bucket load. Bristol always had a funny way of stopping it. And when I say funny way, an illegal way. They've always...
I'm quite old school. I'll call it clever. Get away with it, it's clever.
Yes, they've always been played very fast and loose with the legality of stopping. And it's very clear, like you said, it's very, very clever. And they've always been a frustrating team to play against because they are very clever in terms of stopping from a line out, and they disrupt us. I have a sneaky suspicion at scrum time they were doing exactly the same thing. They were very, very clever. They just, and we were a bit slow to, effectively, they managed to get the referee's ear on what they were doing, and we were too slow to react to it. I think if we'd got Hazy on the field, I think we may have been able to have another, just been able to work it out.
I've seen him obliterate Lahif, you know, plenty of times. And,
I think they knew that. Yeah. I think Bristol knew that we had them at scrum, and they basically went, if this is a straight fair fight, we don't have it. So therefore, we've got to manipulate. We've just got to change the way this is going.
Often, what happens is you'll see sort of Tigers take a step forward, which I noticed in them, and then all of a sudden you think, shit, are we going backwards? And it's actually because you let the prop sort of almost move past you, so you can get onto his shoulder and just create that bit of an angle. I could see we were a bit pissed off about a couple of penalties, but hey, that's the way it goes sometimes. Bit of a lottery, isn't it? And I'm sure we've won plenty of dodgy penalties in our day. But let's can't get away without talking about it. Let's talk about the kick by Tom Whiteley at the end. 2 minutes, we've got the ball. He kicks the ball, and there was he got a lot of stick for it. A lot of it went over the top, which wasn't fair, and it wasn't right. But the... when I was watching that, I've got to be honest, I didn't have too much of a problem with it. And actually, it was a good kick. And I think we actually briefly had it back. And then somebody, I'm not sure who, and I'm not saying it was, you know, kind of a cock up by then. It could have just been a difficult ball to take. It then coughs up and spills into Bristol's hands. The reason I didn't have a problem with it is because throughout the game, one of the consistencies was we hadn't been good enough at looking after our own ball. It was the reason that we didn't score more points in the first half. We were on their line for most of the game, and we didn't score more than a try in that first half. What did we score? Two, I think, in the first half, didn't we? Was it Hurst Collins with two? Yeah, two. So we didn't score two. We should have had three or four, given the amount of time that we were on their line. But I think we got turned over three times on the 5-metre line because we weren't looking after the ball well enough, and it happened plenty of times outside of that as well. In that last 2 minutes, the refs, if you're trying to see out the game with one out carries and guys sort of like rucking over, the refs are just desperate to penalise you for sealing off. So not only are you struggling to say, well, hang on, we haven't really looked after our own ball particularly well all game, this is a dangerous area where we can give them basically another 30, 40 metres of territory. We've also got this situation where we're fighting against the ref as well. And so him putting the kick up, and as it turns out, I thought it was a good kick. We had a good chance to get it back, but I don't think what you expect is the ball to spill and land perfectly for Bristol and for them to basically then have a 40-metre break up field. I certainly don't put that on Tom Whiteley. I thought the quality of the kick was good. And, I think that pointing the finger at him is incorrect.
No, that's fair. I was a bit sharper on Twitter with Tom. So if you are listening to Tom, you're probably not. Apologies. It's an interesting thing because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Because if you do, if you throw in it, if you go through the phases, you either get done for seeing off or you throw an intercept, you're going to get shit for throwing an intercept. I think for me, I would have, just because we're down to 14 against a team that are lethal from broken field, I'd have rather have took my chances on the referee calling us for sealing off rather than put the ball in the air. Because as much as you have a good chase and as much as you have a good kick and all the rest of it, it can still be a lottery. And what happened can happen in terms of the ball can bounce, the ball gets slapped down and it can go anywhere. And you, at that moment in time, you've lost control of the ball in terms of the percentages. Instead of it being whatever is in your favour by going, by running the risk of being sealing off, the ball suddenly becomes a 50-50 lottery and it could go in your hands. It can go into Harry Thacker's and he runs for 30, 40 yards through a gap. For me, I would have just took my chances because if we were in our own half, I would have said you kick it because you, if you can see the penalty at that point, you're going to be on the 5 meter line. Because we were in the Bristol half, I took my chances on the ref and almost forced the referee to make a decision. Because even if he does do you for sealing off, you're going to be on the 10-meter line because of the angle of where the
rupture is. Yeah, I think that's it. If you keep it tight around the touchline, that's one thing. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't because, playing... It's not like it was in the early 2010s where you saw teams go for 4 or 5 minutes, didn't you? Like picking and going.
So it was Munster basically did a whole, pretty much a 5 minute process of just going from side to side.
Wow.
And they did like Northampton by it. And I think Northampton got so irate. It was so dramatically obscene. I think it was 5 minutes where it was just crap rugby, but they got away with it. I think it was sort of seen that it was like the point of going, yeah, we can't have this.
Yeah. Well, that was it. And if we'd have, kind of done that, and, I've got to say, I thought McGinty's touch finders were really good all game as well. That probably feeds into our thought process. And we effectively then kind of seal off. We'd say, well, why the fuck are we messing about with the ball here? And I suspect that probably feeds into their thought process as well, is to say, look, I know we're down a man, but defensively, we've been pretty good when we've gone through the phases. Bristol haven't had a huge amount of change out of us. We'll be able to kind of lock this out. And, as I say, I don't think you base the quality of the decision on necessarily what the outcome is, which I know sounds bizarre. Say, whether or not it's the right decision is almost entirely decided by the outcome. I think that there was enough kind of, if I'm going to get legal with it, that went on after the kick. We actually had the ball in our hands to break the chain of causation, if that makes sense. But look,
just before we go on, I'm really intrigued by this because you play. So I'm really intrigued by your thoughts on this.
I think even part time is generous for me playing now.
I'm just more intrigued by fifth, just in terms of this is just a thing, not just in this instance, but across a lot of our kicks. I can understand the slap back when you're going one handed. We are very guilty of going two handed and slapping it back. The question I would ask is, if you can get two hands on it, surely, why are we slapping? This is why I don't know, because I haven't played in such a long time. Why are we slapping it back two-handed? Wouldn't it be better to catch it? Because in goalkeeping, if you're a goalkeeper and you can go two-handed to punch it, you're always told, if you can do that, you might as well catch it.
So I think the difference with the goalkeeper is that usually when you're coming to claim a long ball or a cross, is that you're coming towards a ball, the ball is coming towards you. And so you've got full view in your peripheral about everyone who's coming up. Now, when it's a high kick, you're looking up and it's quite hard to get. And the ball's coming from behind, effectively almost coming from behind you, or it's directly above you at all times if you're chasing well. So you're going to struggle effectively to know what the peripheral is. And therefore, you know that the likelihood is it's going to be a contested catch. And therefore, you know that effectively you try and get two hands on the ball, there's a good chance you're going to knock it on. And usually I think what most sides do now is basically you have your lead chaser and you have three guys who are sort of set around him for that tap back, which is, we did it very successfully about three times as well, I think, in the Bristol game as well. The kick chase was good. The kick quality was good throughout, both from Tom and from JVP. For me, the big thing was the game was not lost by that. The game was lost by our inability to score more points, as you said. in that, particularly in that first half. And Lord knows we had opportunity. I mean, it's you know, like the Gloucester game, it's one they got away. It's a sickener. It's a feeling, unfortunately, we've had to get a bit used to this season. But shall we do some three-word reviews to get this done and dusted and draw a line under it? Elliot, you've been scouring Twitter. What have you got, mate?
First one from Melanie Adams, who put done for season. Yeah, I think, sadly, I think the percentages were less than 1%. So it's not totally done.
No, but I think it's mostly done. I think that there's, you know, a chance that we need to get seventh to get into the Champions Cup next season. Because if Gloucester win the Challenge Cup, effectively, they
eighth
go
eighth place losers.
Yeah, eighth place losers. So, given our fortune of the draw over the last few years, I wouldn't be completely adverse to having a run in the Challenge Cup and, you know, a realistic chance of some silverware. But obviously, we've got that to play for as well.
Yeah. So, it's just a shame that the playoffs if we'd won, we'd still be in the sniff, albeit a slight one, but hey ho, it's done now. The second one was from Sam Moss. It just made me laugh, because it's so simplistic, and I do agree with it. He just put rugby is shite, and it makes me laugh. And you just go, it's so unfair. Sometimes sport isn't fair. Sometimes sport is cruel. And in this instance, the rugby gods were not shining on us. And there is something funny about us going, rugby's shy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Ludicrous game.
It's a stupid
it's
game.
It's a ludicrous game.
I do it every time we lose. Like when England lose as well, you know, there's obviously a lot more podcasts about international rugby. When England win, I'm listening to absolutely everything. When England lose, I delete the app, basically. I delete our own podcast. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear
you
about
get back
it.
Into cricket.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I start following the Foxes very closely, just, you know, every other week. Okay. I've got a couple here. I like this one from John Hutchinson, which, as we discussed, season summed up. That's about right. It feels like so close on a lot of fronts, but limited in others, and that comes to play. And then a few percentage points off, and we lose the key moments, and it's really frustrating. And I'm going to finish on a positive. Jack Scott, who, to be fair, had about four cracks at this, so it's a bit unfair. He's done four attempts at three-word reviews. We know Ollie's mojo back. And I think that could be for Hassel Collins. I assume he's talking about Ollie Hassel Collins. But I think Chesham as well. Chesham was my man of the match. But I don't think his mojo ever left. I think he's been sensational for most of the season. But Hassel Collins, yeah, he looked a proper handful. Delighted for him. One of the biggest privileges of this podcast is occasionally getting to speak to Tigers legends. And this is the first time I think it links in where one is an opposing coach of a team coming to visit again. It is the great man himself, the B of the ABC club, Mr. Richard Cockerell. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourselves?
Getting by. Managing to dodge another half hour out of work to do this, so not complaining.
Good.
This is weird because I always look forward to seeing you come back. I wouldn't have put money on it being as the coach of both the club side, Black Lion, and also as of the national side in Georgia. So it seems like a match made in heaven in terms of, like, obviously your style of play and your rugby ethos. How do the two things in terms of coaching the club side and the national side work together, and how did the opportunity come about for you?
Well, firstly, I mean, I think it's been well publicised that the opportunity came around because I got the sack at Montpellier. So,
I see the positive opportunities. Yes,
that's the life of a rugby coach. Sometimes
they haven't done much better without you, Richard.
Let's not go there. So, obviously, I was available mid-season, and Georgia just finished the World Cup and we're looking for a new coach. And I applied for the job effectively and was successful. So, one, I was out of work. Two, I think the Georgian role probably suits my skill set and mentality and coaching style, whatever that is. I'm still trying to work out what my actual rugby philosophy is. People have asked me for 20 years. I'm still not quite sure. But so I think it was a good fit. And obviously, the Black Lions is a new franchise. This is only its third year to help bridge the gap between club rugby in Georgia, which there's a 10-team Didierati league, which is semi-professional. And the Black Lions is the franchise that leads, sort of is the bridge between test matches and club rugby. So we're a small rugby nation, as you guys will know. So it does make sense that the national coaches at this point coach the Black Lions and the national team, because we've got a small pool of players, 50%-ish play for the Black Lions and the rest are in France.
Looking at the role you've undertaken, Richard, it's quite a large project. There's quite a lot of different facets to it. In terms of the project itself, what's the setup like? What are the pathways? And ultimately, what's the end goal of what you want to achieve and where you want to take, you know, where you want to go with yourself in this role?
The infrastructure in Georgia is very good. I mean, it still needs to be improved, but it's growing. There's a great foundation for us to build on, which is there's a lot of hard work going on in the last 20 years to get to where we are today. I think, I mean, the end goal is to try and get the Georgia national side and the Black Lions into competitive competitions in the mainstream competitions in world rugby. So, for example, the Black Lions, you know, we'll make every effort to improve our standard of play and what we do at club level so we can join the URC, for example, and the national team to keep developing and putting pressure on world rugby to invite us into the Six Nations or another type of competition where we can test ourselves, as Italy have had the opportunity to. You know, Argentina having super in the rugby championship in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, with respect to all the teams we play at the moment, we're too good for the competition we're in, and are we good enough to be in the other competitions yet in the Six Nations, for example? Well, I think we've got some improving to do to be consistently competitive, but unless you're given the opportunity to develop, whether it's at club or test level, we're never going to be able to develop to that level. So Italy joined the Six Nations in, you know, what was it, 2001?
Yeah, 2000.
You know, the Italian sides were let into the Rabo Direct or whatever it was at the time, URC, 2011-12. So those, you know, Italy have got a bit of a head start on us. But and that's the end goal for us, to keep developing the pathway. We have a good pathway. 18s are very strong. Our 20s are very good. They're well coached. We have good resource, and we don't have big budgets, but we have a passion and a drive to get better with the people that we have.
I think it's a really good point about how much work's been done in the 20 years sort of building up to this, because I remember in 2003, I think they were in the group with England, and I think they had 80 points put on them, and you know, it wasn't the worst result in that World Cup. I remember there were some ridiculous scores, but that it's not the same anymore. Like if you get drawn with Georgia, you kind of wince and go, well, this is going to be a very, very tough game. It's going to be a very difficult encounter. You'd still expect a side like England to win, but it wouldn't be the gimme perhaps people thought it was before. But of course, certain sides would be more nervous than others. And I'm looking at the Welsh at the moment, and I particularly loved the tweet that went out, obviously calling for a playoff game. Very cheeky. I don't know if you were behind it or not. I'm sure I'll get another comment.
I don't do social media. That confuses me. No, our president Soso is a very colourful man, and he's more than happy to stir the pot.
Have you had any response from the Welsh? I expect silence.
Oh, I think there's been a little bit of big discussion around potentially playing, but because of the way the fixtures are, you know, there potentially might have been an opportunity to play outside of the window, international window, but for us that doesn't work, because we have, you know, over 50% of our squad playing in France, and you know, if we get to play the big teams, we have to be at full strength as they should be. So there's a true barometer of where we're at.
Now, having seen the Portugal England A game, I mean, I think that shows an example of where it did go badly in terms of getting that mismatch. I don't think anybody really learned from that, so I can understand your point of view on that one. In looking at the game on Friday, what's the sort of background to this? How did it come about? Did Leicester approach you, or did you approach Leicester, or was it somewhere in the middle?
A little bit of both. James Wade at Leicester has been in contact with Georgian Rugby Union several times around relationships with Leicester and playing games at all levels of the clubs. I suppose it was, if we go coming to the UK, obviously we're in Edinburgh at the moment. We played Edinburgh and Glasgow A team on Thursday. And obviously I have good relationships here. And obviously Leicester is, they were interested, and my relationship with Leicester over the last, you know, however long, it seemed to sort of make sense. So, look, Welford Road's an amazing place to play. Leicester are the most successful English club of all time. That's, you know, still not forget that. So there's a lot of kudos of playing at Leicester for us. And I want us to go to a club that has huge history. You know, we're 3 years old, you know, Leicester a little bit older than that and have a little bit more history. And it'll be a real, real experience and test for our players. You know, we're a really young rugby nation. You know, kids don't play rugby at school here. You know, they don't play rugby until they're in their early teens. So, to experience Welford Road, and what that means to the Leicester players and crowd, and us to go and, experience that and earn the respect of, hopefully earn the respect of the Leicester, the team and supporters is important for us.
I think I'd speak for the vast, vast majority of Leicester fans when they say that they're really intrigued by seeing what Black Lion are going to bring. If everyone wants to see Georgian rugby grow, and there's a lot of people who I'm sure not to the same level of frustration, but share a degree of your frustration that there seems to be this ceiling that's put on Georgian rugby at the moment. But obviously, because of that, we don't get to see a huge amount of Georgian players regularly, certainly not playing together, and certainly not Black Lion at the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about, without giving the game plan away, what we can expect from Black Lion on at the weekend?
Well, historically, obviously, Georgians have been very forward dominated, and we're really building that with the national team. Georgia have got some great backs. You know, we've got the Black Lions have some exciting backs, especially at 10 and wings. We've got some real talent. We've got Booker, our captain, you know, 104 test matches for Georgia, is a great leader and a great inside center. And we've got some talent. No one will have ever heard of any of them. Acker on the wing is our record try scorer for the Georgian national team. So we've got a lot of talent. Georgians are very committed, exceptionally committed physically. Technically, we're still improving. You know, the nuances of the game are the things that the young players pick up a little bit later in life. So, we'll have a team that's physically very committed. As you know, I don't mind my teams being like that, whether it be Georgians or Leicester or anybody else. So I think we'll give Leicester a test on Friday night, and we expect a tough game. And to be honest, the results, not irrelevant, but for us, I think it's just us showing what Georgian rugby is about. And putting on a good spectacle and a good contest, and hopefully getting the invite back in the future so we can keep developing our game.
You mentioned obviously Fridays and a fantastic opportunity for the players to go over to Welford Road and to play and to experience that. And it's an emotional, you know, it's an emotional time for them to experience it. But for yourself as well, Richard, it's obviously, you know, there's personal feelings involved here for yourself because it's, you know, you're coming back to Welford Road as well. You know, the photos yourselves still on the walls here. Everyone holds you in still so much regard. So in terms of obviously yourself, how are you feeling about the return back to Friday and the sort of the emotions that the return to Welford Road brings for yourself?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit too old and cynical to get too emotional. I'll enjoy it. Like, you know, obviously the best years of my rugby life, both on and off the field, were at Welford Road. So, you know, I'm very proud of what I did as a player. I'm very proud of what I did for the club as a coach. You know, some people like me, some people don't, but hey, that's the world we live in. So, but my record stands up against anybody's, and it'll be really weird being in the away changing room. And it'll be really weird sitting in the away coach's box because, It's you know, I've known only the home change rooms and
coaches. Turn right. Is it turn right instead of turn left? Have you got to try and make sure that you don't go and sort of sit on Dan McKellar's lap at some point?
Yeah, have you got a map of your way section to make sure you know where you are?
I'm sure the supporters will put me in the right direction, no doubt. I'm looking forward to it. I've only happy memories of being at Leicester, and it's a great club. I think it's for us as a Black Lions team, it's a privilege for us to be able to go there and play. So I don't think it's about me as a homecoming. I think it's really important that it's about the players and the Black Lions and Georgian rugby. And look, I hope Leicester put a decent side out, and I hope they really test us. And I think they will, and I've no doubt they will, because as I know myself as a player and a coach, if you put a Leicester shirt on, whichever team's picked or whoever you're playing against, certainly at Welford Road, there's a huge responsibility that comes with that. So I know that Leicester will have their eye. If I was Dan McKellar, I wouldn't be worrying about Black Lions. I'd be worrying about Sale next Friday, the week on Friday. So I know there'll be a very mixed team, but Leicester have got a strong squad, a great youth setup, and I expect us to, it'll be a great experience for us, win, lose or draw.
Obviously, Richard, as it is a Tigers podcast, and I grew up on the terrace watching you play along with a lot of the other people in the old cotton jerseys. We've got to ask a couple of questions to finish up with about your time at Leicester, and I'm going to do the risky thing and give you an imaginary time machine. If you could go back to one particular time at Leicester, what would it be? What would you be doing?
Oh, crikey me. Playing? Training?
Specifically, was that basically, it's a cheesy way of asking, are there any sort of particular memories that stand out for you from your time at Tigers?
I mean, there's hundreds, but I think probably some of my first memories at the club when I joined as a, 21 or 2 year old, I can remember my first season. Obviously, we were amateurs in those days. So I came in the change room on, or the entrance to the change rooms on a Thursday night, and the team for Leicester Barbarians was up, and I was in the team to play against the Barbarians on Boxing Day. I think it would have been Boxing Day 1993, and I was in the team. And in those days, that was the biggest game of the season, and it was a full house Boxing Day. It was just, a great night out on the town afterwards. And for me, it felt like at the time, coming from Coventry previous season, it was like that was the game. To play against the Barbarians for Leicester on Boxing Day was, utopia. And it's those sort of simple little memories for me that make the club probably for me very, very special. And being with a special group of players and a special club, special supporters, it'll go up and down, results and coaches will come and go, but the club and the fabric of it and supporters will always be the strong part. And it's, I still see it as a very much a proper rugby club.
Your time as a player, Richard, saw you took was a central part of being a pack that was, it was feared, and it took on all comers, and you didn't shirk a challenge no matter who you played. Who was your toughest opponents that you played as, both on an individual basis and on a team basis? Is there one where you look back and you just go, oh, that was a good one? That was just a real tough, real good old battle.
Well, probably front row wise, myself and Graham Rowntree, same age, in our early 20s. Darren Garforth was a little bit older than us, and still is, as far as I know. We used to play against Oral, against Sammy Southern and Hitchin, and they were tough opponents as really young men. And I suppose the others that I can remember is those first early days when you used to play Bath, when they were the best team and we were the ones chasing, and Graham Dorr and Chilcott, Victor and Buga, those types of players. And, at the start of our time together as a front row, they dominated us and bullied us a little bit, I suppose. And as they got older and we got older and we got to our mid-20s and they got to their mid-30s, when the table started to turn, that was I can remember those days when we were beating up Graham Dorr and alike rather than them beating us up. And it was, that was probably the turning point when we first beat Bath at home to win the league. It was the day that the dynasty of Bath and the dynasty of Leicester started to grow in that era, I think.
That's awesome. I love that. Any excuse to regale a win against Bath, I'm always here for, to be honest, even if it is 25 years ago, that's fine. I've got two quick fire questions I've been asked to ask you. One, the stuff about Leicester Tigers training with you involved was always legendary. Very quick question. Did you punch Austin Healey hard enough?
Probably not. But a lot of people did.
And the second one was, when you were playing Tigers rolling ball, obviously what we've taken our name after, was the thing of legend. Neil Back always at the end of it. Is there a certain part of you that is pissed off now to see hookers at the end of rolling ball as a staple? Because did you miss out basically on 60 tries for the Tigers because of that?
No, well, not really. I wasn't very skillful. Like, I wasn't very good, but I was quite tenacious. So give the ball to Backy, do the grunter up front, and let Backy take all the glory. So look, it was
he likes that as well.
Oh, is he still the record try scorer or something? Is he for rolling balls or total or something?
When we spoke to him, he did drop it into conversation. He wasn't asked, but he did drop it in.
No, yeah, I'd not like Backy to talk about himself, is it?
I think Montoya's still got a long way to go to catch him up. But in terms of obviously looking at Tigers, so you had some great trips abroad in Europe and obviously on domestically as well. Is there a favourite away day that you look back on with specific happiness, whether it's the game itself or shenanigans afterwards, or just the entire trip abroad that particularly stands out?
Oh, crikey, there's so many. I mean, I think that the first years of European rugby, Bob Dwyer took us to Po one year, and we beat Po away from home, and we didn't even know where Po was, to be honest with you. We were these, you know, hillbillies from Leicester that sort of, Po, where's that? I was in France, okay. And it was a tough old game. I can remember John Wells getting eye gouged, and there was just one hell of a punch up, and it was, you know, it was absolute carnage. And then afterwards at the reception, you know, the lads that were punching your head in and poking in the eyes were buying you beer, and we had a great night out in Po in the Black Bear pub, I think it was. It was an amazing place. and just drinking with your mates and having fun with supporters. You know, in those days you go to a bar and you could drink with supporters and you could have a good time and do stupid things. There's no phones. Remember?
Yeah.
Imagine no social media and no phones.
I'm actually imagining the horror if they did have phones back in your nights out, Richard, to be honest.
How
many tapes?
Billy Polar had nothing on us.
How many tasers would it take to bring you locked down? That's it.
I mean, you know, it was the days where if you just denied it enough, it didn't happen. So, no, we had a really, really good night out with supporters and just enjoyed the game for what it was and the people that supported us. And those are probably the memories that sit firmly. And most of the players of my era probably enjoyed those parts of Leicester as much as anything else, really.
Richard, just to finish with, we thought, firstly, on behalf of all Tigers fans, certainly specifically myself and Elliot, thank you so much for giving up your time. We can't wait to see you on Friday night. Really, really looking forward to it. Is there anything that you'd like to send, give you the floor just to say about the game itself and send a message to Tigers fans?
Well, look, come and support your team. Come and support the Black Lions. You know, for the one or two that want to come and support me, please come along. I mean, come and enjoy it, you know, because we're a good side. We're going to turn up at Welford Road and we're coming there to win. And we're going to give it our best crack. And Welford Road with a good crowd, there's not many better places in world rugby to be. So I'll see you Friday night at 7:30.
Richard, it's been class, an absolute honour having you on. Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you. My pleasure. Cheers, guys.
Right, well, we've just heard from the magnificent Richard Cockerell. Cockers, thank you so much for sparing your time for us. It was an absolute treat. And I think he gave us basically the rundown of Black Lion as well as his fantasies about punching Austin Healey. But I think then what's left for us to do is to have a think about the Tigers team. Just a reminder, game Friday night, is it 7:45 kickoff?
Half seven kickoff.
Good. Don't get there 15 minutes late like I would be then. It's included in your season ticket. It's going to be a wicked chance, I think, as we'll get to see some of the young talent who a lot of us have been crying out for to see. But obviously, because of the I suppose the limited fixtures that we now have, we've been less able to do it. So I think it's going to be a really good chance to see some of the best talent that we've got coming through against a really exciting different team. So make sure you get down there. It's included in your season ticket. Be good fun for everyone.
It's even reasonably priced if you're not a season ticket holder. It's £15 for adults and a fiver for under 18s. So
it's a steal.
It's a deal. It's a steal. And for fair, you can sit anywhere you want in the stadium for that price. So that's a one-off.
Imagine that. I mean, like, I'm very wedded to the terrace, but that's dangerous, I think, because for me, I'd be like, do you know what? I am going to sit in the cat stand in the fancy seats. Just enjoy the high life for a game.
And then
you get comfy. Yeah, exactly. It's like in one of those shows where they show, yeah, here's what you could have won. Why fucking show me that? But there, that's class. I think it's fair to say that I'm not expecting us to go full, you know, double barrels with this, but I am expecting to see a good team of guys who are pushing for selection and some guys who, you know, we may not have seen a lot of, but who may be leaving. I'm thinking senior players. Is Guy Porter fit? This could be a really good game for him to have a last hurrah.
Well, Nick Dolly as well.
Yeah,
you know, Nick Dolly was in the warm-up on the weekend, so he's fit. Whether he's fit enough to play is another question. The club have done an article today sort of previewing or just sort of saying about the game on Friday. Team news comes out Wednesday morning at 10, which is...
helpful, a typical.
Yeah, so whatever I now say and whatever you now say will be largely irrelevant by the time you've heard this. It'll be interesting, actually, to see how well we get to the team between us both, if we can pick a team. And how far off we get. But they have sort of hinted at who will be sort of names featuring, with Finn Carnduff, Joe Woodward, and James Whitcomb all cited.
Yeah, I was going to say they're all going to start, so that's fine.
And then the poster for the game had Kieran Wilkinson on. So I think there's four players that you can sort of, I would set your stall, that are going to feature. And I think it is a good opportunity. Actually, when the team, the fixture was announced, this is a real good education for young forwards in terms of the proofing school to get you up to speed. Because as we heard with Cockers, they are physical and they want to put a number on this.
They've got guys with over 100 caps for Georgia. You're not a mug if you do that. These guys are going to be brutal. It's going to be really physical. I think Booker, who is their captain, he's a 12. He's going to be against Joe Woodward. That's going to be a fantastic physical battle for him as well. And I think that we've got a real good opportunity to sort of, you know, be aggressive, play like Leicester Tigers do, and also kind of like for guys to try and show what they're capable of as well. Really, really interesting. What have you got for the front row?
Whitcomb.
Yeah.
I think Dolly will play, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's Fanes or Finn Theobald Thomas.
I'm going to say Finn Theobald Thomas, maybe Dolly on the bench, I think.
That's fair. It always comes down to how match fit Dolly is, because he's in the warm-up.
There is also the fact that you want to be able to, if you can, you are allowed to use a bit of sentiment and selection on this as well, I think.
Quite, yeah. I think even if you just bring him off the bench for the last 5 minutes, I suspect it won't be 7 or 8 subs, so I think it'd be about 10, 12 subs. So I think there's an opportunity to get him on. So I think let's go Finn Theobald Thomas. Either Dan Richardson or Tim Hoyt on the tight.
Tim Hoyt for me.
That's fine.
He's going to be here next year. He's going to make a step up. Let's put him against the Georgian front row and see how he goes.
Yeah, that works for me. I would have Tom Manns with Harry Wells in the second row.
Always happy to see Tom Manns since he complimented me doing the worm in Copperface Jacks. So he's a big fan. So yeah, happy to see Tom Manns. So Lewis Chesham still.
I just don't know if he's fit.
If he's fit, I want him playing. God, that's a tall second row, Tom Manns and Lewis Chesham.
It's, to be fair, work at line outs. That's what Lewis Chesham used to do in the Prem Cup last year. It was brilliant. Literally just put his hand, they get thrown up in the air. Because he's got a massive wingspan, he just knocks it back.
Yeah.
Just put him on front step. So I've got Tom Manson and Harry Wells. Back row, Finn Carnduff at 6. either Josh Manns or Emeka Elioni at 7, and I expect to see Cracknell or Havrell at 8.
I expect to see Rogerson at 8. Is he injured?
He was on the injured list, so...
Maybe that explains it. Maybe see Havrell at 8, Carnduff and Elioni for me.
Yeah, that works. 9, do you go Sam Edwards? Do you go...
Do you go Lenny?
Yeah.
I say give Lenny the captaincy. Let him take the side out. Then you've got an experienced bloke ordering everyone around. I'll go Lenny.
Yeah, that's fine. Wilkinson at 10 for me.
Yeah.
Centres, I've got Joe Woodward at 12.
Yeah.
I would like to see Guy Porter at 13, actually, because I think that would be a good... I think Guy would be a good guide in hand for...
Yeah,
Joe Woodward.
And I think you need some experience dotted about as well. So yeah, I would also go for Guy if he's fit and if he can get a game. And again, a bit of sentimentality. He deserves a send-off.
They may go Matt Scott. If Guy's not fit, because obviously he's coming back from a head knock, you've just got to be careful of what can be done. And if that is, I wouldn't be surprised if Matt Scott turns up at 13, just again as that guide in hand.
Yeah.
Wing's tricky, because we haven't got any.
Yeah, who's available?
So it'd be, I think it's Kinder or Kimber. I do apologise if I got that wrong. And Sayatala as the development wings.
Yeah, Sayatala's an exciting player, I think, from what I've seen as well.
He's lightning quick.
Yeah.
And it's got England in the 20s recognition. So it's clearly got something about it. And then at fullback, Elliot Gourlay, I think, would be a good option. That's what he's played for Loughborough all season, so he's had a good year down there, and he was in the Prem Cup playing at 15 as well, so I think this is a good opportunity for him to get some game time. Fair bench, it will just be a whoever, you know, I think there'll be 10, 12 names, and it will just be some of the more younger lads after that. But that's a team.
Yeah,
it's 15.
it's 15. Yeah, I suppose, again, like, it's like, do you want to give Ollie? I suppose actually probably don't, because of the injury issues we've got. You don't want to put first team wingers in, because we can't risk any of our back three getting injured in this game. As much as I think we'd want to put, you know, kind of a couple of first teamers, or at least one, have one first team winger out there. I just think we're so stretched in the back three. I think it will be that development back three. But, you know, there'll be a lot of pace. There'll be a lot of invention, a lot of attitude with it. Yeah, it should be exciting. I'm very excited about that team.
Yeah, me too. I think, and also there's a couple of guys just in terms of, like, Cameron Mile as a loose head in the development team. That really excites me.
Archie Van Clear, he might be with Nottingham, but I mean, he was voted in their player of the season shortlist, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that tells a story of how good he is and how good a year he is. I think Nottingham have got a game this weekend, so I suspect we will respect Nottingham and let Archie play for them, which makes sense. So yeah, Cameron Mile, I'm really intrigued by, see how he goes. If Lewis Chesham does play, really excited to see him, see how he's progressed. Tom Manns, I think, if he is featuring, you know, considering he's been kept on for next season, really like to see him have a go and see how he gets on, because he's clearly going to be, he's clearly done something right to be getting a contract, which is great news. So I'd be intrigued just to see how he gets on, and just as a foot, and if his brother Josh Manns gets a game as well. He had a really good Prem Cup, and sort of under the radar, Josh Manns has sort of built up,
I agree,
quite a few appearances without really sort of getting the headlines. He's actually picked up quite a lot of games. So it's a great opportunity for young lads to really put a marker down and to really get, you know, get a bit of recognition for future years.
Not going to do score prediction because we don't know what the team's going to be, and we don't know a lot about Blackline, despite Richard's excellent efforts to educate us. I'm just hoping that basically, if we can sort of shore up in the scrum and match up in the forwards against a very, very talented Georgian side, then I think it bodes well for the future. Thank you, everybody, for listening. That's the end of the podcast. Please do leave a rating and review if you like what you listen to, and we will see you all next week.